All right, we are back and now joined by Eldon Thompson, whose third book in a trilogy of fantasy novels, The Divine Talisman, is just out this Tuesday. So, Eldon, now that your series, or trilogy, whatever you want to call it, is wrapped up, can you tell us a little bit of what it's about for readers who haven't picked it up yet?
Okay, yeah. The idea sort of started, I was writing from a really early age. I was thinking I was 8 years old when I started writing. You know, I fell in love. I grew up with Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, fell in with, like, Terry Brooks and all the really well-known Lloyd Alexanders, the epic fantasy stories. And so I, exactly, and I wanted to read all this stuff, and I wanted to write all this stuff because, like most kids, or most families out there, pretty poor, didn't have anything else to do. This, you know, couldn't only watch and buy so many books, watch so many movies, and was always frustrated when they ended. And eventually got to the point where, like, you know what, I can write my own, and then I don't have to wait for someone else to put out the sequel. I can do it myself. So I wanted to do that, but the problem was, as time went by, I wanted to do something different, obviously. No one wants to rehash the exact same stuff. Some people do it on accident, whatever. But, you know, you want to try to be different. The same but different. It's the old saw. So what happened is, for years I was trying to write something really original, just devise something that had never been thought of before. And it got me into a lot of trouble. I started actually going to writers' conferences and speaking with well-known writers and learning from them. And they all kind of told me, you're too far out there. You're trying so hard to be original that, you know, stop trying to redefine the cosmos, because we have nothing to relate to when you're within worlds, within worlds, within, and there's nothing for us to tie ourselves to. And they basically said, you know, what you're trying to write is a coming-of-age adventure story. So go home, write that, and trust in your own voice to make it unique. And I thought, well, okay. So what I ended up doing is going home and reevaluating this coming-of-age adventure story that I'd written way back in junior high, and had written all three books, and looked at it, and it had to be rewritten from page one, but it kind of had the outline of something that I thought I could use. And what I did at that point was, I thought, why don't I take, instead of fighting the traditional fantasy elements and tropes so hard, why not use those? Why not take the exact same, because there's been things that you see over and over and over again, conventions you see repeated ad nauseum. And I thought, and there were always certain things about a lot of those that struck me as unrealistic. And I know that's kind of an oxymoron in fantasy, but I wanted to write sort of a realistic fantasy. I wanted to write what, you know, you always see the orphan farm boy who becomes king. But, you know, how does that really have any, whose parents were, how does that make him a king? You know, it's more about, you know, what they do, anyway, you know, the boy goes out in the world and falls in love with the first girl he meets. You know, there's all these things that happen, and I wanted to use those, but I wanted to kind of point out how silly they can actually seem, or how it'd be realistic to do a different way. So the series, this long answer is all about saying that the series is basically your standard coming-of-age adventure story that anyone who's read fantasy has read 1,000 times. But the deeper you get into the series, the more these conventions start getting turned on their head and being, you know, the opposite of what you would expect, or at least sort of things get unraveled when you get to the happily ever after part. Things start unraveling quickly when you start finding out what happens to the relationship formed in a crisis situation, you know, between the first girl you meet when the crisis is over, and things like that. And it just, you know, there's lots of standard conventions, especially in the first book. And as it gets along, it gets a little more twisted and a little different.
That's cool. Now, you are a screenwriter living in L.A. When you started to rework these books, were you already working as a screenwriter?
I wasn't working as a paid screenwriter. What happened, I had written these books when I first went to UCLA to study screenwriting. I figured if I'm going to learn the art form, I might as well learn it from a place, you know, and people that have experience with it. Yeah, they're one of the best. So I went there, and I did The Crimson Sword, my first book, which was named something different then. I ended up writing that as a screenplay. So the story changed drastically from book form to movie form. And then, again, it changed drastically from movie form to book form as it evolved. But, yeah, I did do the first book as a screenplay at one point. The book series kind of came out after I'd graduated from UCLA, and I had a few scripts under my belt, but nothing had sold yet. The book series, the offer for the book series came before I sold anything in Hollywood, yeah.
And did you find that having the book deal helped you sell screenplays in Hollywood, or do they really not care about that?
They don't care a lot, but it is. No, I actually do tell people it's amazing. When you don't have the book deal, you're one of a million people trying to, you know, knock on the door and barely get an answer. Once you have the book deal, People do look at you completely different. It's like you got really smart all of a sudden in the last 24 hours, because yesterday you're nobody and today you're somebody. And, you know, we haven't read your books. We're in Hollywood, so we don't actually read books, but we see the fancy cover. We see the big font on the name, and, you know, you must have some idea what you're doing. And then, yeah, a few people will actually, you know, crack the books and look at it, and then it gets you somewhere. But yeah, it does. It does make a big difference. Once you start to make a name for yourself in one arena, it transfers over for sure. Yeah.
So they just crack it. They don't read it. yeah, you're not making any friends right now, you know. But seriously.
They know.
I think it's pretty safe to say that everyone knows that screenwriting pays better than novel writing does. Now that you are a working screenwriter, do you want to keep writing novels?
Yes, I do. I actually have an interesting story about that. There's a I don't know if I should mention his name or not, but one of the really top agents in the genre that I met a couple of years ago, and he asked me the question. He asked, well, which do you want to do, write screenplays or write books? And I thought, well, why can't I do both? They're different enough in form, and one will drive you crazy long enough. It's nice to be able to kind of take a break and do the other. He did say that books actually in the long run will make you more money, and he mentioned people like George R. R. Martin and Stephen King, people that have these huge followings. And I thought, well, that might be true as you build your own empire and kind of own that. But how many of us turn into Stephen King or George R. R. Martin? And I don't have, you know, I think everyone has those aspirations, but I don't have those delusions. So I'm happy to follow the money. I take it more as a sign of interest, if that makes sense. You know, Hollywood right now, yeah, I've got a couple deals that are throwing a lot of money at me, and I take that as, I mean, they're very enthusiastic. They want me to focus on writing those movies, and that's why they're offering the big money. Publishing, most people know there's less money in general in publishing, and so it's kind of like, you know, if you got one person knocking on your door frantically, and the other person is, you're not sure how interested they are, you know, you kind of follow where the interest is. But I absolutely have plans to do and hopes of doing both for quite a while.
Right. Can you tell us about some of the screenplays you've been working on? Because they will definitely be of interest to our listeners.
The most well-known one is the Shannara series by Terry Brooks. I helped get that set up over at Warner Brothers. They've actually optioned an adaptation I did of The Elf Stones of Shannara, the second book. It seems to be the one people are talking about starting with. But that's also, it's in what they call development hell. As far as I know, they have announced that Mike Newell, director of films like Harry Potter and The Goblet of Fire, Donnie Brasco, Four Weddings and a Funeral, really well-known and well-respected director, has come aboard to direct and produce. My understanding now is that they're looking for a big name, experienced writer to come aboard and do either a rewrite or, you know, they may start fresh. From what I heard, they're still trying to hash that out, decide what they actually want to do with the series, how they want to treat it. So what happens with my script right now is anyone's guess. And we're just waiting to see, on that one. And,
so you need another book deal and then they'll have you do the rewrite.
I don't know that the books will help me in this case. It really, behind the scenes, you know, from what I've heard, and I haven't been in a lot of these development meetings, so some of this is secondhand, but what I've basically been told is that the feeling within a big studio like Warner Brothers is that, you have to have name recognition, even as the writer. Now I kind of argue, I'm like, well, the name that matters is Terry Brooks on this series, just like with Lord of the Rings. It was Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. No one really cared that it was Philippa Boyens, Fran Walsh, Peter Jackson writing the screenplay.
I was a fan. I didn't even know who wrote it.
Exactly. You know, so people care about the author's name and the series name. So you can make that argument. But these people, the executives, you know, they do have to do what's best for their job and what they feel is best for the future of the film. And that entails hiring, you know, a writer that they has known works out there. Nothing I've done yet has been produced outside of a short film that will be released later this year and we'll be doing the festival circuit with next year. But yeah, relatively unknown. So when these guys have to explain to their bosses and their directors why they went with a certain choice, it's easier to justify that decision when they can say, well, this person has done this, this, or that, and, you know, it's a well-known commodity as opposed to, well, it's a first-time writer, and we like the script, but, you know, in case something bad, in case the movie doesn't do well, you know, you don't want to have to explain why you gave the first-time screenwriter, you know, the chance to carry a $75 million film on his back.
Well, it seems to me that gives them a built-in person to blame, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to be political or politic about this. Basically, it's a cover your ass thing. Yes, yeah. You got to be able to say, you know, you did what you thought was best, and you know, so that's what they're doing, as far as I understand.
Well, you know, it seems to me too. At a point, you have to give someone a shot. Otherwise, you have 10 writers that you're just using over and over and over for everything, and you gotta let new people take over the helm eventually.
And it usually does happen, and what happens is the writers that are determined enough will come out. For instance, you know, this project's been optioned. I'm not sitting around waiting for a phone call to come in and do a rewrite. I went out and wrote a new screenplay that now that is in the process of being picked up, and that one should go into production, and that's an original screenplay. It's not based on anything, so that one is supposed to go into production this year, and they're trying to rush it out. They're really excited about it, so if that comes out, makes a big splash, they expect it to, then all of a sudden I have a name, and you know, maybe they do call me back, I don't know. But yeah, there is a way. You just got to keep knocking on the doors, and it, in most cases, I was always told, for instance, in the book world, that you've got to have 3 books in print before anyone realizes you've even written one. And that's true in a lot of cases. There's people who come out with a big splash right away, but most people, even if you look at, like, say, a Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code, that was like his 3rd or 4th book. And then people go back and read the earlier ones. So in a lot of cases, you kind of got to just keep knocking doors down and take your it doesn't usually just burst wide open for you. Someone will let you in a crack, and then you go, okay, and you take that, and then you go get a little bit more of a crack somewhere else. And you do continually parlay. One experience does help you in the other arena, and each new deal you get, people, you know, will trust you a little more.
So what you're saying is that L.A. is about getting crack. That's what you just making sure I heard that right. Well, no, seriously, though, one thing you mentioned earlier was production hell. And can you talk a little bit about the frustration of writing screenplay after screenplay, treatment after treatment, and never seeing a final product versus writing the book, and boom, a year later, it's on the shelf?
You know, you're right. I haven't given a lot of thought, but it is it's definitely gratifying to know that as you finish a book, they're, you know, kind of rushing into the next phase of the publishing. And, you know, you're right. You do have a set time when it's coming out. In the movies, yeah, it's a big question mark. Things can happen really fast, or they can drag out forever, or they can never get done at all. And there is a big question mark. I, you know, these things all, the way I deal with it, the way I was taught to deal with it is to, you know, the old saying, a watched pot never boils. Don't be hanging around over one project, you know, talking to other prospective writers out there. You know, same thing, you know, as you write a book and you're sending a query letter off to an agent or whoever, you know, don't sit around waiting for a response. Always be writing the next thing, whether it be a sequel or a completely different project. Always be working on something that helps you take your mind off of what might or might not be happening with the last one. And that's where I am. Like I said, with Shannara is a good example. Once that was set up, it was clear that, you know, they had to figure out, you know, hire the big directors, the people that are going to be responsible for the film. My involvement, at least at the moment, is no longer needed. So I'm not going to sit around waiting for that call. I'm going to work on the next thing and see what happens with that. And so I honestly don't put a lot of thought into yesterday's project. It's always about the next project.
Are you working on your next book, or do you know what you want your next book to be?
I'm leaning. I've got a couple different ideas, and I need to discuss them still with my agent and editor, but we have, you know, talked loosely, and yeah, I believe what I'm going to do is do a spin-off series. There's a really popular character from the first book. He's kind of my favorite. He seems to be the fan favorite. He actually played kind of the mentor role in a unique way, 16-year-old assassin kid. Everyone seemed to really enjoy him. The reason I mentioned he played the mentor role is because normally in these books, the mentor has to die off so that the Obi-Wan Kenobi, whatever, that gets killed off so that the young person can go kind of earn their stripes on their own. I didn't want to kill him, you know, and I thought there was a lot of story for him to be told. So he kind of disappears from the books. He still figures prominently in terms of, they talk about him. His presence is missed and ramifications are felt throughout the other books. But he's off and away doing his own thing. And I know I have an idea of why he left and where he is, but the characters in this book don't know, and so the readers don't know what happened to this guy. So I think what I'm going to do first, because I have some ideas for other stories within the same world, but probably a generation or two later, different lands, that kind of thing, so that there's some freshness to it. I personally get tired of writing about the same characters after a while. They go through a certain period of growth, and then that's it. That's the story of that hero's journey. And trying to find a new hero in a different journey. Most likely the next thing will be a kind of a spin-off series for this one character who's we see what happened to him and what sort of adventures and trouble and mischief he's been getting into.
And that also lets new readers jump into the new book, and they don't have to read 3 books before to jump into the new one.
yeah, that's certainly a benefit of it. These would be intended to be like a standalone adventure, more along the line of like a Conan series or a Tarzan series, or, you know, Dritz Dorden, Ari Salvatore's popular Forgotten Realms character, you know, a series of adventures where this guy's just kind of doing his own thing, and probably be shorter standalone novels rather than the big epic multi-plot things that I've got doing now. And yeah, give people a chance to get a taste of the world and kind of taste of some of the characters and of the writing, and see if it's something they might want to jump into on the larger scale and on the big ones. Yeah,
but of course they should go get the first three books. That's I'm telling them right now. Eldon, thanks for being with us. Is there anything else you want to mention that I didn't bring up?
Oh, wow! I think that's the big things, is the screenwriting. You know, the Terry Brooks Shannaris. People are excited about that. I hope, you know, cautiously optimistic, I think is the term. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of those. Want to see those done well. And then, yeah, the book series, they're gonna feel familiar, and hopefully, especially the further you get in, you find it was worth the trip. I mean, there's a lot of action. I think the Publisher's Weekly review, you know, is all words like gory and mayhem and plenty of violence and things like that. So it's a Holocaust tale, basically. It gets pretty bloody there for a while, especially in the third book. But you know, yeah, in the tradition of action adventure and big end of the world type stuff, I think readers will enjoy it.
One of these days, someone needs to write a book like that. Lots of where there's gore and everything. You turn the page, and there's actually something in there that squirts blood on you as you're reading.
Interactive, like they're trying to do with films, where you have the scent and the 3D, the 4D film. Yeah, you've been there. Yeah.